ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the United Nations calls on Israel and Lebanon to respect a 10-day ceasefire that's just taken effect. Also, former SAS soldier Ben Robert Smith granted bail after being charged with war crimes. And in Tasmania, a last-minute bid to save a crucial smelter.
This is the only manganese site in Australia. There is no other workforce that has the expertise and skills to run this plant. They are critical for Australian sovereign capacity to produce steel.
A ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon has now been in effect for several hours. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the Lebanese President Joseph Aoun have welcomed the pact. Israel's target in Lebanon, the Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah, has reportedly agreed to abide by the ceasefire with conditions. As Rachel Hayter reports, despite the fragile nature of the truce, many Lebanese people have been celebrating the pause in the conflict, which has killed more than 2,000 of their compatriots.
Jubilation on the streets of the historic Lebanese port city of Sidon. A 10-day ceasefire after more than 6 weeks of war. But in Beirut's southern suburbs, there's less optimism. 60-year-old Mohammed Yassin is one of more than 1.1 million Lebanese people displaced by the fighting. He's living in a tent on the street.
They gave a 10-day deadline, but we don't accept that. 10 days, if we want to go back to our homes, 10 days and the war returns. We don't want that. Either our land is fully returned or we don't want it.
Across the border in the Israeli city of Tel Aviv, these locals are cautiously hopeful.
I don't really trust a terror organization like Hezbollah, but I would like to believe in people and to hope that the ceasefire will last, because we all here want to live peacefully.
History has pretty much shown us that it hasn't worked. I'm not like very hopeful that it'll work. I hope. We can only hope for the best, I guess.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu welcomed the opportunity to make an historic peace agreement with Lebanon, but confirmed the IDF will continue to occupy a 10-kilometre-wide zone in southern Lebanon.
We remain in Lebanon in a widened security zone, and we are not leaving. This allows us, first of all, to break the danger of infiltration into our communities, and secondly, to prevent direct anti-tank fire into the communities.
The Israeli military has destroyed the last bridge crossing Lebanon's Litani River and warned residents not to move south of it. Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah has reportedly agreed to abide by the ceasefire, but is demanding it include a comprehensive halt to attacks across all Lebanese territory and no freedom of movement for Israeli forces. Since the ceasefire came into effect, the Lebanese army says there have already been a number of violations, including intermittent shelling of Lebanese villages. The US President Donald Trump says he hopes Hezbollah acts nicely during this truce and has invited the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Lebanese President Joseph Aoun for talks at the White House.
It's very exciting. With Lebanon, it's very exciting. I think we're going to have a deal. We're going to have a meeting, first time in 44 years, and Lebanon will be meeting with Israel, and they're probably going to do it at the White House.
When do you think they will...
Over the next week or two.
The UN Secretary General's spokesperson, Stefan Dujarric, has welcomed the ceasefire and offered support to uphold it.
As we've always stated, there is no military solution to this conflict.
The Australian Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, has welcomed the ceasefire too and called on all parties to the conflict to adhere to it. Australia will attend a meeting chaired by the United Kingdom and France later today to discuss joint efforts to restore freedom of navigation in the Strait of Hormuz.
Rachel Hayter. Nora Ingdahl is the director of the aid group Save the Children in Lebanon. She spoke to me from Beirut a short time ago. Nora, what's the scene in Beirut this morning? Does it appear that this ceasefire has taken effect?
Well, we have had reports that there has been breaches of the ceasefire in the south. Reports from the Lebanese army. I've also been in touch with my colleagues in the south, saying that it's very fragile. Up here in Beirut, it's been a calm night, no bombings, no loud sounds. So here it might look like the ceasefire is actually happening here in Beirut.
How has the conflict been affecting children over the last few weeks?
Children desperately need a break from the ongoing brutal hostilities that has been going on now for the last 45 days. 168 children have lost their lives. Many hundred have been injured. So children and their families need a break from the hostilities. And in particular in the southern and eastern part of Lebanon that has been shut off. Yesterday, the last bridge connecting actually the southern Lebanon to the rest of the country was bombed by Israel, which in fact meant that the convoys that, you know, us humanitarian organizations are part of, convoys with medicine, with urgent, you know, medical assistance, was prevented. I think the critical thing here is, will people be able to return to their homes? Because remember that 20% of the population in Lebanon are displaced, 1.2 million. So people are desperate to go back to their homes.
Just describe for us what that huge displacement of people in Lebanon looks like.
It basically looks like that in, you know, schools here. I'm very close to a school here. People are staying packed together by the hundreds, you know, and thousands in collective shelters. These are schools that have been turned into like shelters, so to say. People also are staying, you know, in the streets still, in the parks, because there's basically no way that Lebanon can host like more than 1 million people are displaced. You can also see it in terms of, you know, the constraints on resources, host communities that are receiving thousands of people being displaced, lack of, you know, water infrastructure. And this also increases social tensions between people here in Lebanon. It's already quite a divided society. So social tensions, when there's little resources, also play out.
Do you mean tensions between the Christian and Muslim communities?
No, it's broader than that. And actually, it's also, it's you know, there's a very diverse society here in Lebanon, more than 17 different groups, right? And it's not as easy as sort of Christian Muslim. It's much, much broader. And it's also about people feeling protected, feeling safe.
Nora, can you tell us a bit more about how those social tensions are playing out?
Well, it can be things, you know, like people being displaced. You desperately need a place to stay, right? And you want to rent a house, you want to rent a building. But because Israel has been making targeted attacks, you know, on people being displaced, host communities are afraid and worried to host sort of internally displaced, or desperately need a place to stay. But they are not in, you know, they are afraid also to host them. And then what do you do? Imagine yourself, you know, you're a mother. Let's say you have 3-4 kids. You desperately need a place to stay, but nobody will receive you. And you go to a school trying to seek shelter. The school is packed. There's no more place there. You call whatever friends, families. They already are overwhelmed by having families staying in their homes. And that undignified way of treating people, you know, creates a lot of anger, frustration.
What's your feeling, Nora? Do you feel that displaced people will start trying to move home today, or are they going to wait to see if this ceasefire holds?
No, we've already seen it. We've seen people start moving. Although, as I and my understanding, although this agreement specifically states that people will not be able to return, that they should not return, but you can't prevent people from returning. You know, when you've 45 days, let's say you've lived in a car with your children, with your family, you know, So my big fear now is that people will be returning and it's not safe. And, you know, we will have more casualties. So that's why we need a lasting, permanent ceasefire that will allow the 1 million people to return to their homes.
Nora Ingdahl is the director of the aid group Save the Children in Lebanon. She was speaking to me from Beirut. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on ABC Listen. The company that owns the Victorian oil refinery that caught fire on Wednesday night says it's still waiting to assess the damage. The Viva Energy facility near Geelong is one of two oil refineries remaining in Australia, and there are fears fuel supplies will be affected by the untimely inferno. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, is adamant, though, the setback won't lead to new fuel restrictions. Samantha Johncher has more.
In the wake of a fire that engulfed a section of Viva Energy Group's oil refinery in Geelong, General Manager Bill Patterson says it's still not safe for his team to go in.
Until we get in and be able to safely get into the area that was affected, assess the damage and determine what it was going to take to restore those units, I can't answer that question. But we can run this facility close to full production without those two units.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese cut short his diplomatic trip through Asia to visit the plant today.
The advice that we've received today is that 80% of diesel production is continuing. 80% of aviation fuel is continuing ongoing. 60% of petrol production is proceeding today as well.
He says the fire won't lead to level 3 fuel restrictions. He's also announced that BP has been added to the list of companies in a government-backed fuel security scheme called Export Finance Australia, which allows the government to underwrite the delivery of additional fuel cargoes. As the war in the Middle East continues and the Strait of Hormuz remains closed, there's been intense debate in Australia over what can be done better, including whether the country should have more than the two refineries it currently has. But some experts warn there is only so much the government can do. Dr. Flavio Macau is a supply chain expert at Edith Cowan University. He says the days of cheap oil might be over, and simply building more refineries is not the answer.
Because from a supply chain perspective, we live in the suburbs. Anything that we do here will be more expensive because we are further away. We don't have the same volume, the same scale, the same shipping lines. So if we want to have that, that's okay. We just have to understand there is no free lunch, and then we will have to pay for the extra cost that will come from that.
Petrochemicals are used in more than 6,000 everyday products, from aspirin to construction materials and plastic packaging. Dr. Macau is concerned that in the wake of this oil crisis, the costs of all these things will go up.
I do think it is the end of cheap oil because, say that everything goes right today, the war is over, well, it will take months to reestablish the flow of oil, to repair the refineries, to put the tankers back online, to readjust the contracts and insurance. So it will take a lot of time for that to go back to what we could call normality. On the other hand, many governments had a wake-up call from that, and they will take measures to protect themselves from such crises in the future, and that protection will cost money. So that money will probably mean that they will have to invest, and then they will have to charge more for their fuel.
He says the only way to keep prices at the levels we're used to paying is to diversify.
We have the oil industry as a settled business for over 100 years with a lot of power in that. And at the same time, we have green projects that not always are truly understood by the community and that are sometimes not as reliable or too high expectations, and the delivery doesn't match those expectations. So it is understandable that we have a discussion, but then we have to move the discussion to a higher level and to ask, how much do we want to be independent from those external shocks? And where do we want to invest our scarce money? Into yesterday's technology or into the future technology. So from that perspective, it is a little bit disappointing that we are not doing more towards the future. Hopefully this crisis is a wake-up call to accelerate those plans and ideas here in Australia.
Viva Energy says it's confident it can bring in enough extra shipments of petrol and other fuels to make up for its loss of production at the Geelong refinery.
Samantha Johncher. One of Australia's most decorated soldiers, Ben Robert Smith, has been granted bail in a Sydney court today after being arrested and charged with five counts of the war crime of murder. The charges laid last week relate to the alleged killing of unarmed civilians in Afghanistan in 2009 and 2012 and follow a lengthy investigation by the Commonwealth's Office of the Special Investigator. It was set up to probe allegations of criminal offences under Australian law by Australian soldiers in Afghanistan. The judge today accepted Mr. Robert Smith's lawyer's argument that the case will probably take years to resolve and that it would be difficult for the Victoria Cross recipient to contribute to his defence while in jail. For more on how this case might play out, I spoke to Queensland-based Dr. Sharam Dana, a former war crimes prosecutor with the United Nations. Dr. Dana, Ben Robert Smith's lawyers have told the court today that this war crimes case is uncharted territory. I assume they mean in Australia. Are they right?
Yes and no. I mean, it's not uncharted in the sense of the legal technicalities and complications that will arise with terms of witnesses and those type of challenges. There are complex trials that have had these features before, but it is a unique case. It's a watershed moment, not just for Australia, but globally, in the sense that we now have a state that on its own accord and its own will is holding one of its own accountable for alleged war crimes. So we don't see this. We usually see states covering up the war crimes of their soldiers. We see states making excuses, non-prosecutions. If you look at what's happened in the war in Ukraine, Russia, Gaza, Israel, no one holds their soldiers accountable. So this is a massive step that Australia has taken, and it's a step of great international leadership that they're willing to put on trial one of their own soldiers, and not just any soldier, a soldier that had been decorated.
You've worked on war crimes prosecutions for the United Nations. They're often run in the International Criminal Court. Can you explain for us why this case will be run in the Australian criminal justice system?
The International Criminal Court only prosecutes cases where states themselves have failed to act. So where a state is unable or unwilling to prosecute the crimes of its own soldiers, this is where the International Criminal Court steps in. The reason the International Criminal Court hasn't stepped in is because Australia has taken on the responsibility itself. It has done investigations. It has now brought charges. So it is itself holding its own soldiers accountable, which is what we want. We want states being responsible themselves and prosecuting war crimes themselves. We don't want it all going to the International Criminal Court because, quite frankly, the International Criminal Court doesn't have those resources to prosecute all the cases. The states have to take ownership of this.
When the Commonwealth of Australia's Office of the Special Investigator announced the arrest and charging of Ben Robert Smith, it referred to the difficulties with evidence and witness testimony, given these alleged crimes took place in Afghanistan. What do you think some of those challenges are going to be in the trial?
Well, certainly there is going to be evidentiary challenges on several levels. First of all, witnesses. If the witnesses are Afghans, how do we secure their testimony at trial? Also, there's challenges in terms of gathering forensic evidence or evidence at a scene or just even images that the jury may need to see to understand the context and the location. I mean, some of these crimes are quite brutal, including one that's alleged that he kicked the man off of the edge of a cliff and that person tumbled down. So to be able to bring these images and pictures to a jury here in Australia, that will be a challenge, but it's not an insurmountable challenge, and we have the technology and capability to be able to do it.
And Ben Robert Smith's defence team have told the court today they expect this case will run for years or take years to finalise. Do you expect that to be the case?
It doesn't have to be. It just depends on how much resources the Office of the Prosecutor and the Office of the Special Counsel are willing to put behind this case. So It doesn't have to be something that takes a long time. It's not particularly more complicated than a complex murder that involves multiple actors or involves organized crime. The only challenge here is, of course, the witnesses are abroad and the evidence is abroad as well.
A lot of those witnesses will be former and serving Australian soldiers too. That was Dr. Sharam Dana, who's a former war crimes prosecutor with the UN. In Tasmania, pressure is mounting on the state and federal governments to intervene to prevent workers at a manganese smelter from losing their jobs. The Liberty Bell Bay facility in the state's northwest went into voluntary administration last month. It's the latest site in steel tycoon Sanjeev Gupta's GFG alliance to go into administration after the Whyalla Steelworks in South Australia and the Tahmoor coal mine in New South Wales. Alexandra Humphreys has more.
It takes more than 200 workers to keep Australia's only manganese smelter operating. Liberty Bell Bay in northern Tasmania is one of the area's largest employers. It entered into voluntary administration last month. Most of its workers have now been told they won't be paid after next week and will either need to take leave without pay or be made redundant. It's a stark choice for fourth-year apprentice boilermaker Michaela Binns.
This is probably the best job I've ever had, and I don't want to leave it.
Liberty Bell Bay is the latest asset owned by Sanjeev Gupta's GFG alliance to collapse amid mounting debts. In South Australia, the Whyalla Steelworks was forced into administration last year. And last month, a New South Wales court ordered the Tahmoor coal mine be wound up. There are multiple investigations underway by the Australian Securities and Investments Commission.
These workers cannot afford to go without pay.
Robert Flanagan is from the Australian Workers Union. He points to the multi-billion dollar package promised by the Commonwealth and South Australian governments in the wake of the Whyalla Steelworks collapse. He argues Liberty Bell Bay workers also need a government bailout.
This is the only manganese site in Australia. There is no other workforce that has the expertise and skills to run this plant. They are critical for the manganese production that comes out of this site. They are critical for Australian sovereign capacity to produce steel.
Mr. Flanagan believes a sale of the smelter is likely and could happen within the next few weeks. He wants governments to pick up the wages tab until then, at an estimated cost of $1.6 million a fortnight.
The cost of what we are after, what we're seeking, is so much smaller than what has been invested in South Australia.
Susie Bauer is the chief executive of the Bell Bay Advanced Manufacturing Zone. She's worried losing the workforce could mean that interested buyers walk away.
I would encourage the government at all levels to do whatever they can to maintain this workforce, because without the workforce as well, it'll make a sale a lot harder.
Just yesterday, the Tasmanian government ruled out helping to keep the workforce paid, saying it had no capacity on its balance sheet. 24 hours later, there appears to have been a reversal. Energy Minister Nick Digan indicating help is coming.
The government is working on a support package for the workers at Liberty Bell Bay. We would see a role for government, state government and absolutely, definitely the federal government to provide some support to the administration process to make sure those workers get paid.
Tasmanian Liberal Senator John O'Dunham argues the Commonwealth government has a responsibility to act.
Whatever the support looks like, it needs to be provided. We have had billions of dollars of support provided to smelters elsewhere to secure sovereign capability. We just want a fair deal here in Tasmania. We just want these workers, this smelter, to get the same treatment that they've had on the mainland.
Federal Minister Julie Collins left the door open to Commonwealth support.
We certainly as a federal government have been open to working with them and to see that what we can do as a federal government, but I'm sure that this is devastating news for those employees and their families today, and certainly my thoughts are with them.
In a statement to PM, Industry Minister Tim Ayres said the Australian government is working with the Tasmanian government to ensure workers and local suppliers are supported and receive appropriate assistance.
Alexandra Humphreys. And that's PM for this week. PM's producer is John Stewart. Technical production by Joram Toth and David Sargent. I'm Samantha Donovan. We'll be back on Monday evening. Have a great weekend. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. What's Vladimir Putin been up to since the start of the Iran war? Well, he's one of the only beneficiaries. Today, international relations expert Rajan Menon on Trump's threats to withdraw America from NATO and whether Europe can defend itself against its hostile neighbour. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.